Many people are still unaware of the history of the Virginia tribes and the true stories regarding first contact at Jamestown in 1607. Please join us as we speak with the Monacan Nation in Virginia regarding the first contact and paper genocide of the Virginia Indians. Monacan Chief Kenneth Branham and tribal members Karen Wood and Sue Elliott sit down with Chickahominy Tribal Representative Powhatan Owen to share the history and culture of the Invisible People, past, present, and future. Years of history, and we find the remains of ancestors removed from their burial mound, where stones sank in the welcoming grasses and would have stayed, sentinels over a shrine to the spirits entombed there. But the river changed course. It did not save these bones. It was lifting them out of the earth. 900 years before us, 50 generations, the earth diggers, Monacans, knew the land and buried what remained of their families in 13 known mounds. The dead were safe where they lay, until, at an appointed time, we lifted stones and carried our relatives to sacred ground, releasing their spirits. Acquired 4 nights of music and fire, the dark wood charred into ash. We reburied them by a dogwood grove, our mound rising 15 feet of earth and Monacan bones. Encompassed in mist, its spirits lifted towards the sky. Of the mound, what now remains but a small hump, plowed down, the ceremonial stones thrown away? So little is left us. Nothing really. Save those few who listen with their blood who might save our people. Scientists, sifting through dirt for the scars of wood postals, tell us how to reconstruct our homes. Stone axes, chipped flints, potsherds. We locate our markings on earth. As the only descendant of a nation, we remain to find ancestors stored in warehouses, bagged, labeled, their spirits neglected, dust pressing their bones in the spirit of historical research. We are left among ruins to save what we can. Our grandparents, who did not depart but remain among us, as we may after 900 years. We would bring them home, give their bones to the cradle of earth, their songs and our quivering through the stone. We are their families, weeping for stones we cannot find, for the blue shroud of spirit rising like breath, for the tattered earth we recognize but have not been able to save. Remembering stones, rivers, hills, dogwoods, spirits. We are safe for now. The earth and sky remain.
This poem came out of an experience where I went to a museum in Richmond and encountered photographs of our people's bones displayed on the walls, and that was really a sickening experience to me because we knew they were our ancestors. The Monacans were coming to the mound to grieve. There are at least 13 mounds that have been identified throughout the Piedmont and the eastern part of the Blue Ridge as part of this one complex, and it's related to the Mississippian mound complex as well. The dead were buried in the mounds. They were considered sacred. And when Jefferson had this mound excavated, he became known as the father of American archaeology because he documented what he found inside. So students in archaeology courses today learn that Thomas Jefferson was the first archaeologist in this country because he dug up Native American remains. To his credit, he put them back, which subsequent archaeologists didn't do. They kept them in boxes. The bones he found were disarticulated. In other words, the people's bones had been collected and then they'd been reburied. They weren't buried like a skeleton that had just fallen there. They were collected, and that was part of the ceremonial complex that we had at that time. So they're incredibly important to us. They're one of the things that identifies us as Siouan people and members of a specific kind of culture. So they aren't identifiable anymore. And some of those collections of remains have been removed and they're still sitting in the Smithsonian and we can't get them because we're not federally recognized.
I see.
think we feel that all of the stories misrepresent the Monacan Nation, in that we're always portrayed as being barbaric, savage. John Smith wrote about us as people who didn't do a lot of planting, but just sort of lived from hand to mouth, and that was totally untrue. We had been farming corn for more than 900 years. So generally when our people appear in the history books, we are not painted in a positive light. And we would like to correct that because we see ourselves as people who were simply defending our homeland, much the same as what we call homeland security today. We didn't want to leave. We were just, you know, regular people trying to get by, and then this invasion happened. And I think we did try to be helpful in a lot of cases, but this onslaught wasn't going to stop no matter what we did.
You must have been a sight, Captain John Smith, as your dugout approached with Jamestown's men, sporting plumed hats, puffed knickers, beards, stockings, funny little shoes. You might have even looked to us, well, uncivilized. We fought you, we know, because you wrote it down. One man was left behind, wounded, at your mercy, among your shining goods, mirrors, knives, firearms, glass beads. Where was mercy? Maybe you left it in England. Eager to learn, Captain Smith, you asked about the worlds he knew, whether there was gold, why his people had fought when you came to them in love. He told you in his dialect, which no one now speaks. You recorded his name, his words, not his fate. All the words our people spoke in the year of your Lord, 1608, only his answer remains. We heard that you were a people come from the underworld to take our world from us.
Captain John Smith sailed up the Rappahannock River in 1608 on a voyage of discovery, and his purpose was to look for gold and to explore the lands beyond Powhatan's paramount chiefdom. He encountered some Monacan Manahoac men who shot arrows at him, and one man was wounded, as the poem talks about, and they left him behind. They fled. And through a translator, Captain Smith was able to learn that this man's name was Amarolek, that he was a member of the Manahoac people, who are related to the Monacan, and that he knew of three worlds, he said, Powhatan's world, his own world, and the world of another group of Indians who lived on a great water. And beyond that, he wasn't aware of any other groups of people. And when Smith said, well, why did you, you know, shoot at us when we came to you in love, and what he meant was we came to you expressing friendship. Amarolek related this prophecy to him. And then they apparently got along better after that, and Amarolek took him to his village, and they had a big feast, and they were treated very well. And when Captain John Smith returned to Powhatan's chiefdom, he lied and told Powhatan that he had beaten his enemy, the Monacan, and he was a great warrior, and Powhatan needed to respect him.
At contact, arrival of Europeans, the Monacans and the Powhatan Indians were having some disagreements, some conflicts, and I always jokingly say, we were probably the bad guys. We were probably raiding their cornfields. But, you know, we had a bad year with crops that year, maybe. So the Monacans were the tribe that was between the Powhatan Indians and the Western tribes, so we kind of controlled the trade routes. And to trade with the Western tribes, they almost had to come to the Monacans to do this trading. So, we were a little bit of a problem for the Powhatan. So the Monacans were protective of their land, and they would not lead expeditions past the fall lines of the James River there in Richmond, because that would be into Monacan territory. When John Smith, I guess he saw the opportunity there of making himself look good with Chief Powhatan. I just said, well, you know, he beat some of the Monacans, because they were, Powhatan and the Monacans were enemies at the time, and, you know, it just sort of made him look look good in Powhatan's eyes. So, and I think that's one of the reasons the Powhatan Indians helped the Europeans survive, is they were looking at the future thinking, well, maybe this is an ally that we can use to defeat the Monacans later on. John Smith just took advantage of the situation.
One of the important things to note about Monacan people is that they didn't seem to want to have contact with the English, and we think that we were pretty forward-thinking in that way. It may not have been good for our people to have a lot of contact with the English, and so we weren't written up like the Powhatan Confederacy was. There wasn't a lot of documentation by early English explorers because there wasn't very much interaction between the two groups.
This statement alone, you know, says it all. I mean, there's no getting around that. And I think that, you know, we as Monacan people, like Karen had said earlier, you know, wanted to not have any contact at all. And, you know, here they were, you know, encroaching into our territory. You know, they were coming to us. And, you know, we're wanting to stay like anyone wants to stay in their own home. And the shooting of the arrows and all that would have been normal in any situation. You know, even today, someone came in and tried to, you know, force you out of your own home. To the point that even after all that, he was still took him into, you know, the camp there and fed him and treated him well. You know, that says a lot about the Monacan people. And I think that is one of those stories that needs to be in our history books, you know, in my opinion, because it does reflect on exactly what happened. It tells the whole story and what he had to say.
They say that when the colonists came, that they brought trade with them, that they taught us to trade. They taught us, or they brought a government, like the first government. You know, long before they came, we had a form of government among ourselves. We elected our chiefs, our sub-chiefs, our councils. We had a trading up and down rivers. We had all those things that would make a people exist, really, to trade among each other, to live among each other, to govern among each other, to have religion among each other. We had all these things, and we existed for thousands and thousands of years. It didn't reflect back to the colonists that came that it was their religion or their government or their way of trading. It was different, as well as theirs was different from ours.
Our villages range from maybe 40 to 50 people to some cases several hundred. You know, we would be towns, not villages.
Right.
Here at the museum, you know, we've got several artifacts, and through the help of Jeffrey Hammond at UVA up there, we have some trade items that are historically connected to as far as Florida and some up in Canada, trade items that were, you know, dug up. So wasn't just trading with the Virginia Indians. That's how big the trade market was before contact.
And these places were bursting with trade and things that you'd find in any European cities. In fact, some of them would be larger than some of the European cities because of the trade. And you know, tribes would come there to trade with each other, just like you would find in these European cities. But it wasn't a great deal of difference when it came to the way people lived. I mean, we traded, we farmed, we hunted, things that we needed to survive, and we were extremely well adapted to this land. We knew how to use it to our advantage. We were people. There were conflicts with other groups, but, you know, in most part, we lived in safe places, you know, and we lived in peace with one another. But again, we were people just like everybody else, and we had our own form of government. We had our own religion. And, you know, I always say that the Europeans kind of forgot something on their voyage over here, because a lot of them, they say, came over for freedom of religion, to get away from their kings and their basically dictatorships that they had over there. And the first thing they told the native people that we weren't allowed to speak our own language or worship the way we were, you know, had been for thousands of years. So they kind of forgot something coming across the waters. Amerolac, which came in contact with the expedition led by John Smith, and he told them that there were people in that tribe that had prophesied that would come a people from beneath the world to take our world away. And if you think about that, truer words have never been spoken. So with that prophecy, and we did try to avoid the onrush of the Europeans once they arrived, we went as far as we could, and then we kind of had to, you know, make a stand. And I guess here in Amherst County is where the last of the Monacans end up remaining, because there were no other places to go, basically.
Site of a massacre. Can you say you see only a field or hear nothing but breeze, where the earth raises grass now, the wind, then the barefoot dead run before a gun stock crashed into her skull, thuds of the children collapsing, limp spattered dolls in the center of a village on fire. Blessed are those who do not hear cries cut short, or gunshot or hooves, who cannot feel lingering grief. In the afternoon sun, each rock flashes. In the wind, each blade of grass is screaming.
Well, it's so real. You feel in your heart the actual coming of this, you know, how it happened. This is what happened at times. It was brutal. It was very brutal.
Throughout this country, there are so many different sites where you go, and if you sit there, you can just feel that something like this has happened. And if you go to a place where you know that something terrible has happened, like Sand Creek or Wounded Knee, or much closer to home, there are many other places where there were such massacres, you can feel that there is still some residual grief hovering. And you might not know exactly what happened. In fact, it's even more tragic that we've lost the stories that are attached to those places. But it doesn't mean it's any less real for the people whose homeland it is. And it's so important for us to remember those ancestors and the fact that they struggled and tried to survive for us, that I think we owe it to them to remember what happened to them. Nathaniel Bacon had a problem with Governor Berkeley, who was the English governor of the Virginia colony, and Bacon wanted to get his hands on the Indian trade in Virginia, among other things. He was power hungry, and he devised a way to do that by saying that he needed to step up hostilities against these Indians that were interfering with Virginia's trade with the natives. And in order to do that, he needed to attack certain groups of Indian people. He ended up attacking mostly friendly groups of Indian people, nearly wiping out the Pamunkey in the process, who had been friendly for quite some time. And then he went to the Okanichi people. They had a village on Bugs Island, which is now under water at a reservoir near Clarksville. And he convinced them to attack the Susquehannock people, who were up in the north. And they agreed to do it for him. And when they did, they attacked the Susquehannocks, they beat them, and there were a group of Monacan people who were imprisoned inside the fort. And they all went back to Okanichi town, at which time Nathaniel Bacon informed the Okanichi that they needed to give him all the spoils of the attack, even though the Okanichi had done all the work. And the Okanichi had a problem with that and said, well, no, you know, you can't keep the Monacan prisoners and you can't keep all the furs that we took, because some of that is ours. And at that point, Bacon turned on the Okanichi and put them under siege and nearly wiped them out. So they had to flee and go to another place and live as refugees. Bacon's not very popular with either the Virginia government or the Indians, and maybe that's the first time we ever agreed on anything. I don't know. But he went back to Jamestown, Bacon did, and ended up setting fire to Jamestown in another rebellious scheme, and shortly thereafter he contracted a disease and he died, and that was the end of it.
Well, you know, he's one of those people you read about in history that neither side had a whole lot of use for him, but I think the problem was he had a problem with the governor of Virginia, and they were related. I think he was the governor's nephew, and I think he wanted that position, and you know, if he could defeat the Indians and make things a little bit better for the Europeans, he figured maybe they would follow him. And in the process, he just destroyed some of the Indians that were friendly with the Europeans and didn't do anything to really change any of the situation, only made it worse, because even the Indians that were friendly with Europeans recognized at that point that, you know, hey, we can't trust any of these people. And I think he just did something that made it worse for everybody.
Well, my opinion on Nathaniel Bacon is he's the beginning of the whole concept of destroying tribes, clearing the way. And to me, you know, I know there were other situations before Nathaniel Bacon, but he, to me, his whole getting of men together, soldiers together, to come in and wipe out tribes, he was the beginning of the end. He started it. He showed them it can be done. You know, we can go in, we can attack these groups, and we can pick them off one by one. And I think he just started the whole ball rolling.
It was a massacre. But, you know, when you read the history books, the only massacres were when the Indians retaliated. They don't tell about the villages being burnt and women and children, old people being killed. A lot of times when the men were out hunting, gathering, trying to take care of their families, that was a massacre. But that would be called a great military victory for the European, and even the soldiers of this country later would do the same thing, and they would call them military victories. But when these groups retaliated, then it became a massacre, what they done. And that's the sad part about it. It's misrepresentation all over again.
And I think, you know, I'll just add this to what was said about this, what went on at some of these massacres and killings. To say that the indigenous people of this land didn't war against each other would be, you know, false. We had our disagreements. Villages were raided. But there was never the killing of women and children. If a village was taken, the women would come and they would either blend into the tribe and the children were reared or taken in and they would become a part of that community. But to kill women and children, no, that wasn't a part of my way of life. And to see this happen, we would think, I couldn't imagine what I read before, what they must have been thinking. You know, what are you doing? Yeah, this new way of warfare you have, there's not a word for it.
Word I would come up with, who's the savage?
Absolutely.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who's the savage there?
I would say it's romanticized among the non-native population. Mm-hmm. I don't think we romanticize it at all. You know, this whole mystique of Pocahontas helping the white man and the happy settlers coming over here to establish democracy and free enterprise, and we've talked about that a little bit during this program, those concepts were already here. They weren't just here in the beginning of the spirit of an idea. They were actually here in practice. And there were people who were electing their leaders to represent them. There were people who were operating under a free enterprise system. There was freedom of religion. There weren't the conflicts over religion that came subsequently with the establishment of Christianity here. And so I think there's a certain mythology that makes people feel comfortable about saying there's something justified in the way that America began. And when we look at it, we don't see that it was justified. It was a dispossession. It was a genocide. And that needs to be acknowledged and not romanticized, not just brush over it and say, well, it was so much more important to establish equality for all that we had to push you out of the way. You know, there's something ironically disgusting about that. So we need to say, you know, this was not the birthplace of democracy. It was the beginning of institutionalized slavery. It was devastating diseases. And not to belabor that to the point where everybody feels angry and guilty and people say, why don't these Indians let that go? That was 400 years ago. But to say the relationship is still not equal. We're still not sitting at the table and having a conversation because this stuff is still in the way. You know, let's move it out of the way and really begin to change things.
Here you come again asking, do you see we have nothing to give? We have given like the ground. Our mountains rubbed bare by hybrid black poisons concocted by tobacco. You would spread us on your platform like graven images. You could repent to us, weep into your robes an emotional talk show-like moment to absolve almost 400 years, then go home to mow your lawn. You are not the ones who burned our cornfields, passed infected blankets, treated, pilfered, raped, or traded run. You are not those who ask, how can I help? Offer Indians your jobs, or even vote to save the earth. We are not the ones whose children froze in rivers, whose mothers wore bullets, whose fathers left hearts on this ground. We are not those about whom was said, they haven't the rights of dogs. We are words of tongues no one dared speak. We are nameless, named by others, mulattoes and mongrel Virginians. We are white flints and chips of bone, pottery sunk in red clay, black glass-like spear points found here, of obsidian mined among tribes who lived 1,000 miles west. We are refrains of our grandparents' songs that drift on night winds with our dreams. You call us remnants now, what remains of a fabric when most of it is gone. You have no memory. We sank to scarred knees and said there was nothing else to give. You ask again, will we come to your apology? A southeastern wind answers you. Our ears are not visible, lips are not visible. Oh, we are the bones of what you forget, of what you thought were just lies. Only our eyes look around, earth-toned eyes, forest eyes, thunderhead eyes, eyes flecked with gold, eyes like obsidian, eyes that are seeing right past you.
I was listening to the poem. It really touched me. It did have a little bit more emotion, anger than the others, but how could you say that without being angry? What always bothered me is, Columbus discovered the New World in 1492. I always asked, how can you discover something when there are 5 to 10 million people already there? There's something wrong there, and you won't find it in the history books. And we're working to change that, but it's a very slow going. You read about Pocahontas, the Pamunkey Indians, Chief Powhatan, and then you go to the next chapter, it's like, what happened to them? You know, it's like they disappeared overnight, and people don't realize, a lot of people don't even realize there are Indians in Virginia today, Virginia Indians. They don't even realize that two of the oldest reservations in this country is in Virginia. They need to put that in the history books. They're not federal recognized, but they are recognized by the Commonwealth of Virginia, and they were established through England in 1449. So Pamunkey and Mattapani still live on those reservations. So that is something that needs to be talked to, too, that we were the first contact people. We're still here. You know, we're not fossils. We're not extinct. And all young people can learn that. The racial integrity law did more damage to, in my opinion, Virginia Indians than a lot of the things before that, because basically that law excluded us from being able to be part of the mainstream. Walter Plecker, who was in charge of vital statistics and was the head man, so to speak, in leading this and enforcing this Racial Integrity Act, what he was doing was basically just systematically changing birth certificates, marriage license, and he had a list of names, and he would come to these counties and talk to people, gain some trust, and then they would get a list of names of the Indian people there, and he would send it out to the counties telling them, you will not give them any documentation with Indian or white on it, and you know, they're mixed with Negro blood and should be either put mulatto or Negro down beside any papers that they would need. It did damage in that way, but I think also because of that particular law, it forced us to bound together. If that law hadn't been passed, we would have been treated like everybody else. I think we would have been assimilated into the main society. Instead of 8 tribes today in Virginia, I expect there would have probably been only 2, maybe 3. But with that law, they basically made us invisible.
My grandmother was an Indian at birth. Then the 1924 law came into effect, and then it said there were no Indians in the state of Virginia. You know, you had to be a mulatto or black or white. So no longer could she claim to be Indian on any type of official document. And if she tried to, there were actual threats against the people that worked in the clerical offices that said, hey, if you let her say she's Indian or write down she's Indian, then you're going to pull time in jail. And there are actual incidents where that was enforced. And we were Indian, and we knew we were Indian, and we didn't want to say that we were anything other than that. What that created was the church here came into great play there because they were able to keep such great records. Here on birth, our great-grandmother was midwife, and in her lifetime, it's my understanding that she delivered over 250 babies. Those babies were listed as Indian here on our records. Now, once they got to Richmond, of course, Plecker played around with them and changed things around and put within one family, you may have mulatto, you may have black, you may, well, the term then was Negro, you may have mixed. I even had a sister who had a big zero with a line drawn through it. So, you know, we laugh and say, well, evidently they didn't know what race you were, you know. But
she didn't have one.
Yeah, you know, it was whatever the name was for the day, you know, or whatever the person, you know, decided to put down on there. And this continued. We have one young man in 1970 was born, and it was still going on even then. So we're not talking about something that happened 100 years ago. We're talking about something that was continuing to still happen even in the 1970s. So the law had such a wide range of effect on us, not only schooling, because at that time you had black schools and white schools, and that was it. So there wasn't any place for us. And if the churches hadn't have opened up schools, we wouldn't have had any education until 1963-64 when we went into the public school system.
And even before that, there was discrimination toward the Indian people. Sometimes it was because they could trick people that were not educated into selling their land or taking their land for little or nothing. Personally, in my case, my mother left from here, from the Chickahominy people, in 1927. Her and her two sisters boarded a train and left for New York City to become domestic workers because here in Virginia, they weren't allowed to be called Indians, and they wanted to be Indians. You couldn't attend a church. The only way you can have a church is if it was led by a white minister. You could assemble as a church. So they left, more or less, for a better life. And they went to New York City, worked as domestic workers. That's the only work they could find. A lot of the Chickahominy women, Eastern Chickahominy women, did that and married other Indian people. Some of our people and some of the other people, they moved to Philadelphia, they moved to Baltimore. Some of them mixed with the Lumbee people, left North Carolina, and prospered well in Baltimore. My mom met my dad in New York, and he carried her off to the Mohawk Indian Reservation, and, you know, that's another story. Here I am. I came back. Some of my brothers are back. And it was because of the discrimination and because they couldn't be Indian is why they left. And then, of course, through time, things started to change and be better. And then we started, I think we see almost like a renaissance. It's a coming back. People are coming back now to claim this rich heritage and be appreciative of it now.